Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
And I'm Rebecca Hedman.
And I'm William Gadsby Pete. If you're listening, please like, subscribe, leave a review. Really appreciate it.
Today, we're going to talk about the future of technology as specific to solving climate change as it relates to artificial intelligence. We're going to talk about where innovation meets imagination and this link between art and science and how it can shape a more expressive and impactful future.
Basically, just what is the coolest stuff going on in a number of industries with regards to tech, and what does the future of tech look like for you, our listeners, to sort of prepare for what's coming down the pike and what's going to be the sort of new stuff making headlines in 6 months to 12 years. 12 years? Fucking hell.
That's a very specific number.
That's a very specific number. Leave it in. Leave it in.
Later in the pod, we're going to be joined by the founder of Open Ended Design, Suher Khan. So be sure to stick around and hear her insights about on the topic here. We saw Suher at a conference in Cambridge a couple weeks ago, and we're like, we got to get Suher on the pod, and we did.
Right, let's get to it. The future of tech. What are some of the coolest new innovations that we can look forward to? And specifically starting off with climate change, what's going on there in the world right now? And should we be getting excited about maybe some of climate change actually being solvable by tech?
One of the innovations that jumped out to me is the work that they're doing over at Flash Forests, to kind of rapidly regrow forests that are lost to wildfires. Obviously, a big topic. A lot of cities in the Midwest and in the Northeast, in my home country, are being blanketed by wildfire smoke, and that's really fucking sad. And this company, they use drones, AI, and geographic information systems to strategically reseed the soil in burnt areas. So they've got these engineered seed pods that are kind of the secret to rapid regrowth. So basically, they manufacture these seed pods that contain all the elements you'd need to kind of jumpstart germination in really tough conditions. And they place them and deploy them using drones and embed them into the soil so that you're able to get into these steep hillsides and other places that are otherwise inaccessible to humans. And the hope there is that they can regrow these forests pretty quickly and get them back to their natural work of cleaning the air we breathe. So it's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. And just to solve something like that, it would be super helpful to a lot of people in those cities. So I think when you hear about something like that, you get excited, and you want to see it develop and really turn into something plausible.
Yeah, I do think there is just a bit of a, with climate tech, there does just seem to be more impetus, focus, and actual drive than there ever has been. We've had people on the pod before that are like specialist venture capitalists funding climate tech. It does finally seem that the 2010s, everyone was talking about climate, was no one was actually really putting that much money behind solutions, whereas it does feel like now, the Bill Gates Foundation, quite a few governments really are really driving hard on like what are solutions that, and not just like small solutions, like incredibly complex solutions like Flash Forest, where it's like, okay, we've got drones, we've got agriculture, we're planting seeds, we're planting trees, we're tracking, it's bringing in multiple different fields to create a very complex but impressive solution. We had ClimateX on the podcast before. They are, again, that they're part of that ecosystem. They do a huge amount of data on climate change, on tracking the sort of risks, so you know where to plant trees, where flooding might occur. So it does just feel like there's finally a lot of solutions to these problems where in terms of both technology and funding that wasn't there previously.
Another example that I appreciated reading about, and I'll, as I pick up my NASA water bottle here, is one that was kind of pioneered at NASA from their name, Pioneer Energy, to sustain life on Mars and address problems of pollution. A gentleman by the name of Robert Zubrin, I used to work for NASA in the 80s and 90s, and developed technology to turn the massive amounts of carbon dioxide that exist on Mars into valuable resources like propellants for ships and things like that. So that knowledge was taken and used to develop a technology that can capture nuisance gases from the oil production process and turn it into usable fuel. So not only does it create a profitable stream of propellants and fuel that can be used for energy products, it also takes a ton of emissions of greenhouse gases out of the air, which is brilliant, and like innovations like this give you a sense that, we're actually going to solve this thing through technology. I don't think we should put all of our eggs in that basket. We need to kind of change our behavior too, but it's promising to see these sorts of technologies roll out and say like, hey, actually we can maybe take a crack at this thing through innovation.
The other thing as well, I think that that example as, which again I think is part of the sort of turning point we're seeing, is there's finally profit in it. You know, like, it's before, it used to be it would take someone like Bill Gates, who just has billions of dollars and cares, to just sink money into the solutions with no thought of like getting a monetary reward. Whereas, whether you like it or not, we live in a capitalist society. The way that real change happens is if there is financial incentive for companies and tech to innovate. And it does feel, you know, like something like Tesla with electric cars, multi-billion dollar valued company. There are a lot of people now looking at this not through a charitable lens, but through a capitalist lens of how can we do good but also make quite a lot of money. And that's, as sad as it sounds, genuine progress. You know, for VCs to be on board and thinking about funding solar farms the same way they are funding oil and gas is a pretty seminal point and a real turning point for our society and our culture.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, I do worry that, like, I think we should definitely use the profit motive to kind of, you know, ensure that innovations that are going to like reduce greenhouse gas emissions and mitigate them are important. But also, I worry that, like, it's going to, you know, like push the whole sector towards like only considering innovations that can make money and away from other innovations that like maybe just need to be funded by governments or need to be ground up from communities and things like that. In some ways can, like, we tend to think it broadens and widens innovation, but in some ways it can narrow and sort of, you know, pigeonhole it sometimes. So I think that's a concern to keep an eye out for.
But you know what, with Robert Zubrin in particular, he did work in NASA in the 80s and 90s. So you have some hope there that his true motivation wasn't money, because he's been working in these kind of projects for that amount of time. And I guess with the latest tech that we are seeing, it means that these objectives, these goals are more scalable time-wise, that people are more likely to actually develop these solutions in a quicker amount of time instead of this 30, 40 years that it would have taken someone like Robert Zubrin. So I think that time is also a motivation, and I think people are kind of not competing to see who can do it the quickest, but we are seeing, you know, companies kind of going head-to-head to see who can come up with these technologies the fastest. So I think time is definitely a motivating factor as well.
Robert, if you're out there, this is officially your invite to the Tech Can Save Us pod. You can tell us firsthand if you're in this for the money or for the glory. So yeah, let us know.
I'm sure he listens.
He definitely listens. Come on, guys.
Some of the other areas that to get excited about on the positive note for climate change, I think something we're starting to see a lot of, which is very cool, is like how 3D printing can be used to create sustainable products, materials, and even houses in some cases. Like, it really feels like we're turning a point where we can almost mass produce sustainable prefabricated structures, prefabricated products in a way that we haven't been able to before. And that, again, is real cause for celebration and optimism. And as well, just almost every new, you know, every legacy industry tends to still have quite a lot of waste, but anything really invented in the last 10 years, like, there does feel like it's going to be recyclable. They're trying to eliminate waste and sort of cost it. So yeah, there's a sort of like manufacturing shift, and then also just a general cultural shift that, you know, if you're creating a product, you have to have sustainability front of mind. So I do think that, again, that is cause for cautious optimism.
I was gifted a new robe the other day that's manufactured from upcycled saris from India.
And
I was
amazing.
Like, sweet.
Like,
this
love that.
You know, yeah, it's great.
You know, even more old school legacy, you know, fashion companies, they all have a push for sustainability if they care, you know, about keeping their customers. They all have sort of like new transparency on their supply chains. You know, it is something that whether they're doing it because they want to or because they're being forced to by public pressure, even older school manufacturers are being forced to innovate and make things, you know, more sustainable, more eco-friendly.
I'm going to perform my usual role in the pod and take it dark for a second and move us to new technologies, advancing technologies, and move us over to the metaverse.
I think with the metaverse and Web3, I've actually spoken about this on other podcasts. I'm sorry, guys, I'd been cheating on you.
Scandal.
We've spoken about it before as
awkward
well.
Awkward time to announce it.
I'm taking the kids.
Yeah. And half.
And half all of your shit. Yeah. No, yeah, I do think we've spoken about it before as well. Like, we're kind of like, we're not at Web3 right now, we're at Web 2.5, where there's a lot of interesting concepts out there, but it's kind of like the early days of the internet, where it's like people were pumping money into the potential rather than the reality. If you spend a large amount of time on most sort of like metaverses or Web3s, they're not that great. Like, they're generally not that great. And I say that as a fucking gaming nerd. So if I don't enjoy them, then the mass public level is just, it just is not there yet. But what it just takes is one platform that really cracks the code and understands the things that you can do in a 3D virtual environment that you can't in real life. The example I give is, I think we will in the next couple of years see something like Shopify, which is like a rinse and repeat e-commerce platform that basically any brand can use for like a fraction of the cost it would take to build their own custom website, but in a 3D environment. And I don't mean like you wearing a headset, but that you could access through your computer, you could access through your phone, but you have a 3D digital avatar that can go from shop to shop in an environment, try on clothes, see what you would look like in those clothes, and then if you decide that you like them, order them both in the physical world but also in the virtual world as an NFT that your avatar can then wear. That I think is quite easy to do and just has so many reasons you would do it. I think the other thing we're seeing that it is going to be, I actually think what will really make Web3 and the metaverse sort of mass market and get everyone familiar to the idea the way that sort of Google did to and email did to the internet is sporting events and stadiums. Every major sporting team in the world right now is building some form of virtual stadium, and it does just make sense. If you have even 80,000 seat a stadium, any event you want to go to sells out within like 30 minutes, if not 10 minutes. You have to be there like Glasto tickets.
Beyonce tickets.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have this huge virtual stadium, there's no limit to the amount of people you can be in there. And if you offered me, I mean, I love sport. If you offered me £50 to be in a virtual environment and watch almost any sporting event in a virtual stadium, the answer is hell yeah. So I think that's what will really actually take it mainstream is going to see Beyonce, going to watch the England football team in a sort of environment that you can either in virtual reality or augmented reality, or again, even possibly just on your phone, but like you feel like you can move around and interact with the environment. You have a unique viewpoint the same way that you would, like you're borrowing the viewpoint of someone who is in the crowd with a like GoPro strapped to their head, stuff like that. I think will become more and more commonplace. And like, I that's the bit when someone suggests it to me, I'm just like, yeah, I would absolutely pay money to do that.
Mm. Yeah.
And think about all these companies that would pay money on a day-to-day kind of perspective, would pay money to have those kinds of technologies to educate their staff, to onboard their staff, to, you know, educate people even about climate tech. I think there's a lot of opportunity there with things like VR to actually be applied to day-to-day life and make it accessible. We just spoke a little bit before the podcast started about the Apple Pro headset and that the price point of it made it unreachable. But if it did have a reachable price point, how accessible would that be for everyone? And I think even when we spoke about 3D printing earlier on, I mean, 5-6 years ago, I wouldn't even have thought about 3D printing being a thing. But say from our agency mentioned that her dad literally made like a coffee machine or a coffee grinder from a 3D printing machine. So these things are all things that are becoming super accessible. And I think in a few years, we will be in a situation where people have a lot more access to these things on a day-to-day basis.
When it comes to the metaverse, I'm super like surprised that we have it. Like I think we're still to the point of like web 2.5, like we still have like these kind of rather like shitty video connections where we like stare at screens, like these 2D screens, and like we haven't quite made the jump to immersive environments. Like we have them in gaming, but like in the workplace, for example, like we haven't been able to find a true bridge between like the physical office and, you know, being in another physical office staring at a screen. You know what I mean? Like, so like, you know, this example of Accenture, I never know how to say that, Accenture, having a metaverse office called the Nth Floor. Microsoft obviously has Mesh as well, but like, you know, putting people in immersive work environments and maybe this pisses people off because they're like, I'd rather be at home or I'd rather be, you know, like in person, but you're putting me in this weird middle ground. So, you know, there's that we got to deal with. But and not to mention all the like issues of like, you know, all these commercial investors have these buildings and they have invested interests and stuff like that. But I think it's really interesting. I think there's like a huge leap to be made there and probably a lot of money into immersive work and collaboration environments from moving from Zoom and Google Meet and any other platform that you've been, you know, on mute on all day and shut down on you and all that other shit. So like, I don't know, I think that's a huge area of opportunity for the metaverse and one that I think could actually be good and useful. How much more productive could like designers be if they can sit and like have more interaction and more collaboration in a sort of immersive environment? Insert any other role, I think, you know, we could see real applications for it. So it's kind of interesting. You mentioned, this is kind of bridging off from your last point, but like, you know, the, like shopping experiences and retail experiences, super bullish on augmented reality in general, and specifically like AR mirrors, for example. So like, you know, brands like Coach and Tommy already rolling out digital mirrors to consumers so they can virtually try on different looks. And I think what's so appealing about it is that it like, it saves you time. It saves you effort of like having to like stock your fitting room, try on different things, look in the mirror, you know, and like, and Will, we've just been through this. Like we did a whole wardrobe, you know, change and stuff like that as we became nerdy agency execs here. But like that took a lot of time and a lot of effort. And if this can reduce that, if it can say an AI can like pre-select different clothes that you could try on through an augmented mirror or something like that based on your skin tone and like what matches you really well. And maybe it's advised by like a, you know, a color or sort of wardrobe expert or something like that. And you can try them on virtually and just like throw them in. And then maybe it orders for you and sends it to your house, or like maybe it orders it for your avatar as well, for your metaverse office or whatever. Like that's really interesting. I think it's interesting because it bridges the online and offline world and sort of and unites the two of them. So I'm super bullish on those. I think it's going to be really interesting to see like what comes of these window displays, these AR window displays, these AR mirrors, and just kind of how the retail world takes advantage of this.
And you know what, piggybacking off what you've just said, Paul, I think as well, even as a self-proclaimed like shopping girly, there have been times when, you know, my mental health is that I don't want to go out or I don't want to go shopping. So for those people who are struggling with going out into public and struggling to go to the shops or struggling with maybe like their self-appearance, that would maybe help and aid in those ways as well. So I think even from a mental health perspective, that could really improve and help a lot of people and touch them in different ways.
That's super interesting because it's like, where do you get your fix from? Do you get your fix from like retail therapy? Like, is it from the interactions with other people, with shops people, with, you know, other customers? Or is it like the experience of trying new things on and like purchasing them? And like, you know, you could argue it's a bit of both and stuff like that, but could you get one without the pressure of the other? I think it's really interesting. And yeah, we don't want to take people entirely out of society. Like, I get that, obviously, but that's super interesting to, you know, be able to tick one box there
as well. Like the, as everything, some people just can't leave the house that easy. Like, you know, this, it like, it does make it a little more accessible. And yeah, just around this sort of point up, I do think it's things like that that will actually be the true bridge from some sort of like web two to web three, is like this stuff that is sort of like we already have, but we don't have it that great. Like, I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried one of those, like if you're on a Specsavers website and it's like, hey, why don't you try the glasses on? And it like really badly superimposes the glasses over your face. And like, I have no idea if these glasses suit me or not. Like, if anything, I have less of an idea because I thought these were really nice glasses and now I've seen them on my face and they look fucking terrible. It's just like someone has literally like cartoonishly drawn glasses on my face. Generative image AI stuff like Midjourney could absolutely get you to upload a photo of your face, combine it with the product, and give you like four headshots generated with AI of you wearing those glasses that look completely like real photography. That's really cool. That's the sort of thing, and similarly with, you know, a top, jeans, whatever. That's the stuff I think which will get really quick mass market appeal, real quick mass market adoption, and then sort of act as the gateway drug into, oh, okay, cool, well, I've done that, and like now there's all these other things in Web3 that we can try out and that will get funding now because we've shown how much money this could make.
Can we just agree as a podcast to never use the word fidgetal, which appears in this article from The Drum about immersive shopping experience? I guess it's a combination of the word physical and digital.
It's almost as bad as when Will did AI anarchy.
I stand by AI anarchy in the UK.
What?
One of the podcast titles that got rejected.
I leave for one episode.
It was shameful.
It only worked if you were reading it as text, but it was AI-narchy.
Some things aren't meant to be said out loud.
And I was like, this is the smartest piece of marketing you've ever done. You're a fucking genius. People are going to click on this so badly. And Rebecca was just like, we're not doing it.
Vetoed.
Stop it.
Vetoed.
Oh, God.
All right, so that one's on. Yeah, fidgetal is on.
Fidgetal is out, and AI and the key is also...
AI, I can't even... I'm not even going to say it.
What is it?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a combination of one of the greatest punk albums all ever made and AI, and it didn't work, and we're all disappointed.
Yeah. But honestly, for social media, we should do like stupid banned tech words and just like put that, like, here's the definition, noun, fidgetal, like whatever. Bastardization of physical and digital.
Sometimes you're just trying to get a thing started. You're trying to become that guy who coined it.
Stop trying to make fetch.
Stop trying to make fetch happen.
Yeah.
I'm just going to move us out of Mean Girls and into some of the sort of challenges and opportunities lying ahead for us, and talk about like how how do we encourage more of this? Like some of the cooler stuff we've been talking about, you know, the genuinely innovative, potentially life-changing tech, you know, the stuff that is climate change focused, that really solves fundamental issues that humanity is facing. We've spoken about this in the past, but like there is a unfortunate rabbit hole that tech sometimes gets down where it's like, how can I solve problems that wealthy white 30-year-old men have, because all the people that create tech are wealthy nerdy white 30-year-old men
and can afford them
and so like what you think everyone needs is a £3,000 VR headset when like there are literally forest fires like across the entirety of the US. So I guess,
and
like,
Britain is on the breadline.
Yeah, genuinely, like, I mean, like, genuinely, how do we kind of encourage more of this? Mm. How do we, again, maybe as governments and sort of as a society, slightly put a hand on the scales so that the innovation does sort of trend towards things that genuinely solve problems we care about? Sorry, that's quite a big question, but what do y'all think?
I mean, I think, you know, the idea of like significant government investment comes to mind. You look at Prime Minister Sunak's most recent proclamation about, you know, investing $50 billion into, you know, creating 1 million new jobs in the creative industry by 2030. I think just like government putting its thumb on the scale is, I think, one of the biggest levers. You mentioned Robert Zubrin coming out of NASA. Now he's in the private sector and things like that. So like, we've seen time and time again, you know, government leading, whether it's research grants, whether it's outright funding, whether it's, you know, support for universities and things like that, and just saying, all right, we're going to get you to the starting line and then you're going to take it from there. I think that's, you know, one of the most incredibly important parts of any kind of technological innovation. And there's stuff underneath that too. Like Silicon Valley, again, exists because of, you know, the federal government in the US and, you know, California investing in higher education, which, by the way, Supreme Court has just knocked down affirmative action in the United States as of today. But, you know, we'll get through it. It's fine. But, you know, I just think it's important to recognize that, like, these things don't come from nowhere, right? Like, technological jobs and investment, they come from a concerted government effort to invest in education and tech. And I think that's something that we're seeing the world over. You're seeing it in France. You're seeing it in all these other emergent tech hubs that, you know, hey, we're investing first and we're building on our strengths and then we're growing from there.
I do think there is the one, yeah, caveat to that, that I'd say is, like, I completely agree. But I do think government has to put more emphasis on, like, not just tech, like tech for tech's sake. And I do think there's a bit of a hamster wheel we get on where it's like, oh, it's a tech company and it'll explode. It's more of that, okay, look, we're going to offer grants, funding, and research sort of incentives to people trying to solve the greatest sort of issues of our time, you know, the climate change, poverty, you know, accessibility, you know, that kind of thing, rather than sort of like, oh, I've created an alternative to Uber, which we already have six of. So I think that's maybe where especially the UK government has fallen down in the past. It's just tech for tech's sake. I think there does need to be more of a concerted effort towards the stuff that really will change the world and quite frankly save the world.
Yeah, and I think they need to go to the core as well, because they've got this creative careers program, and at present I think there's about 92,000 students so far who have come through that. And I think they need to focus a lot of their attention in schools, colleges, universities, and really push creative tech careers, because I think there's a lot of innovative ideas to come from that. I mean, a lot of the tech startups and tech founders that we see is often, you know, university students who have come through that way and been inspired to start their businesses. We had Dami Hashtrup, who spoke about his collaborative effort between him and his university alumni. So I think there's a real opportunity for the government to really focus in, because we have some great universities here in London. When you think about Rishi Sunak and this $50 billion that he wants to grow the creative industry by, I think you have to actually think about where the money's being broken down and how he can invest it into universities and education in that front.
And I think like how we invest it is key as well, right? Like, is it high time that we replace cursive with coding in schools? Like, honestly, like at what point did we stop teaching children how to like churn butter and raise barns and like, you know, sort of, I don't know, build electrical circuits and like, you know what I mean? Like, honestly, like, and I think those transitions are hard as well, right? Like that, you know, we feel attached to these elements of the past because they give us warm nostalgic feelings, but also we need to like point to the future. And also, you know, the education system, I think, in many ways tends to lag sometimes in terms of, you know, absorbing, because it's hard to keep up with all of this stuff, even when you're like, you know, well-informed, in-tune citizen who's like trying to pay attention and keep up with these things. So
yeah, I mean, we literally run a fucking tech agency, and like, you know, we are more than humble enough to know that we are only aware of like 20% of what's going on at any time. I do think as well, like in terms of education, it is just like, this is what it's such a, and this is always the problem with governments, is they never actually take a far back enough step and a long-term enough sort of view. So, you know, in the UK in particular, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, education's fucking underwater. Like, you know, teachers are leaving the profession in massive droves. So you're never going to be able to revolutionize the schooling system so that you teach kids code instead of cursive until that they can think that they're going to be able to teach kids how to read and write and do maths. Like, that's where they are right now with class sizes of like 30 or 40 kids. And the government doesn't realize, like, you know, if you want to make London the tech hub of Europe, like they keep saying they do, it's a 30-year project, and it involves education, it involves creating a society where people can thrive, you know, it involves free healthcare that's easily accessible, because at the moment the NHS waiting times are insane. If people aren't healthy, they can't contribute to the economy. And I think what we have seen is in countries that do get that to a better extent, you do see more progress, like Scotland's sort of knowledge cauldrons, like One Biohub.
We might have to add that to the list. Knowledge cauldrons.
I'm just saying. I love that.
I don't know. It just seems like
literally crafting a social post as
it just seems like an old word with a new word ish. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm
struggling.
I only realized how weird it was as I started saying it.
Yeah,
but
I strangely love it. I don't know why.
I mean,
I just like cauldron. You don't see.
Yeah,
cauldron,
you guys are.
Like, you don't see cauldron that often.
It grabbed me.
Brits. Sorry for our North American friends listening in here.
Scotland has a thing called knowledge cauldrons, which are basically just like, you know, tech innovation centers, like one called One Biohub. And they're doing exactly that. Is what we've just spoken about. They provide a space for scientists, entrepreneurs, and government to come together to collaborate on projects specifically trying to solve problems in the world of tech and in the world of climate change, in the world of, you know, food poverty, in the world of, like, you know, insert pressing issue. That's where they collaborate. So I do think we have a roadmap and we can see how we should do it. We just need to execute.
I think it's really good that they're diversifying and diffusing where the spend is. Like, we talked about London as a tech hub, obviously, and episodes here, but like, I think there are loads of promising young entrepreneurs and kids out there who have great ideas who just don't have the resources like a place like London has, and they can't plug into, you know, scholarships and fellowships and incubators and accelerators. And I think that's a problem, you know. So like how do you identify the talent that exists out there and then push the resources to them, you know, so that those folks are invested? And I think that's a really interesting, I don't think we need to call them cauldrons, but I think, you know, there's other ways to, you know, innovation hub zone.
So for the last topic, Will, Paul, you know, you both founded Literal Humans. For those listeners who don't know, we are all part of Literal Humans. Will and Paul are the co-founders. And, you know, it started at a time, you can talk a little bit more about it individually, but I guess Literal Humans started at a time when we were kind of really starting to see the world kind of embracing all this new emerging tech, and it's just been going on snowballing from there. So how do you each think that this has been incorporated into your vision for the company? How do you see it further being incorporated into your vision for the company, and what are some of your experiences with that?
Yeah, it's a good question. We've been quite lucky and also sort of unlucky to have started the agency at a time when tech has been going absolutely bananas. When we first started the agency was 3 years ago, right at the start of AI, blockchain, Web3, all of these massive technological revolutions happening all sort of at once. And, you know, they've slowly picked up steam until, you know, AI has become literally the most dominant topic on probably everyone's lips. So, yeah, I think the key fundamental point for agency owners is you really do just need to embrace this or you're probably going to get left behind. I don't think that AI or tech or Web3 will ever replace human marketers, but I do think it will always be a human using the tools. But if you are a human using those tools versus a human not using those tools, you're definitely going to outperform them. So I think one is, like, the very beginning of it is a attitudinal shift. It took me and Paul a while. Like, we had learned how to do digital marketing from a more traditional school. You know, we've had to actively upskill ourselves. We've had to, on, like, how you can use AI, what we could do with AR, VR, you know, escape that kind of mindset of, like, is it a Facebook post? Is it a long form blog? Is it a traditional video marketing bit of content? So it's a philosophical shift. And then after that, yeah, I mean, it really is just you have to really stay on to the cutting edge of all of these trends, you know. AI is moving at a rate where it changes every week. The stuff you can do with ChatGPT truly is pretty incredible if you understand prompts fully. So yeah, you know, if you're doing anything with copywriting at all, that should be part of your stack already. Some of the other stuff that's out there, like, you know, Synthesia, barred. You've got to be experimenting with it. Even if you're deciding not to use it, you have to know why you're not using it and what you're doing instead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this is relatively true, if not more so true, when we started the agency. Slightly less so true now, and decreasingly less true, I guess. But like this idea that like 68% of online experiences begin with a search engine, that's changing, right? So like, now, you know, yes, you need to flood the market with content, whether it's, as Will said, like a blog post, a video, an infographic, you know, a podcast itself, any form of content to appear in those search results if you're looking to get your message, your product, your service out into the world. But now think about how much time people are spending on ChatGPT and Bard and Midjourney and some of these other platforms. So the online experience is changing. And therefore, if we're thinking about it from the agency perspective, you know, agencies are shifting how, you know, like thinking about questions like, how do I get my clients' products to show up in AI search results? You know, how do I get them integrated into? So we're thinking about search, and we're also thinking about just online experiences in general in different ways. And I think that's going to be a really fundamental shift that's happening under our feet that we're all trying to kind of navigate and figure out. And to Will's earlier point, like, yeah, like the agencies that are going to survive are the ones who embrace it and the ones who, you know, try to feel and understand and I would argue experiment their way through it. And the ones that don't aren't going to survive, frankly. And it's going to be, and also like the overlay of that is like, it's going to be rough for all of us in terms of how, you know, jobs get taken up and jobs change and how much people, the thing I worry about the most is like how much people are going to be asked to learn so quickly. You know, like that really worries me, because people have families, people have other commitments and stuff like that. And like, you worry that we're going to create this, you know, even more stratified society where like the fastest learners who have the most capital, be it, you know, social resources or time or money to learn and learn quickly, can do it. And they can outpace the rest of us. And you're already seeing it, you know, the Udemy's and the, you know, Coursera's, people just go and they learn really quickly, or YouTube, and then they get those jobs, and no one looks at what school they went to or anything like that. I can't tell you a single person's university on our entire staff, right? Like, I cannot tell you that, which is absurd. Rewind 10 years ago, I probably would be able to as a boss. But yeah, I worry about that, like in that more social strife, more, you know, sort of division in that sense.
Like a survival of the fittest, almost evolution. Well,
and it's almost always like, you know, this is, to be fair, this has been the way for forever, but it's like, it's always a 25-year-old.
Yeah.
That has nothing else to do, and like,
well, he lives in the basement, his mom's making him food.
Yeah, and, you know, like, orders, and like, I mean, and like, I used to be that, like, yeah. Genuinely, when I learned how to do digital marketing, I had nothing else in my life, I had nothing else, like a kid, a mortgage, I was living at home. And in about 6 months, I went from being a journalist to being a good enough digital marketer to become a consultant with it. And that was when it was a different school of thought. But like 10 years younger me is now doing that with AI and prompt. Mm. And like that's what's scary is, like, you know, you get replaced so quickly. And, you know, I barely have time to fucking brush my teeth anymore. Like the idea that I could dedicate 6 months to upskilling on AI, it's just not. Feasible.
It gets me nervous as like a person who runs an agency of like, hey, I've hired you and I've articulated that this is your role description, but like in 6 months to a year, that's going to change dramatically in some cases, depending on the role, depending on the agency, depending on, you know, the clients that you work with. But like, how do you, you know, account for that? Yeah. You know what I mean? In terms of compensation, in terms of benefits, in terms of, yeah.
And even taking on not even just like new members of the team, but your clients. You know, you may be taking on clients with, you know, one of our strongest feats here at Literal Humans is that we do human to human marketing. So with our clients, how do you guys tackle this introduction of AI and taking them through our journey with AI? Because some of them may be scared about it or worried that it may affect our mantra of human to human marketing. How does that kind of play into your vision when you think about these new emerging technologies?
I think like one of the core pillars of human to human, you know, marketing is personalization. Mm-hmm. And you know, you look at this stat here about 80% of consumers are more likely to purchase when brands offer them personalized experiences, right? Like, so yeah, exactly. So like what you feel really catered to. So like, what is more human than someone speaking directly to your personal proclivities and, you know, desires and you know, preferences, right? Mm. So I think that like centering ourselves around that and then trying to personalize at scale in a way that feels authentic and feels meaningful and is sustainable from a production standpoint, for, you know, when you talk about writers and social media marketers and designers and things like that, I think that's one of the keys. And but again, like, does AI make that easier? Does it make it harder in some ways? How do you get, you know, people to wrap their heads around that? How do you get the right audience research and data to be able to execute that so you know enough about people so you can personalize? I think that's one big problem that we're trying to wrap our heads around.
Almost all of this tech makes you more efficient. Like, it doesn't replace you, it just makes you more efficient. And even the most powerful use of ChatGPT, at the end of the day, a professional writer needs to sit down with what it's outputted and discard about half of it because half of it's dog shit. So, and that might change, but that's where we are right now. So yeah, there is still that human element in everything we do. It's just adding more power and firepower. And one of the things that, like, AI in particular might genuinely do for the marketing industry is actually somewhat democratize it in terms of, like, offering more power to smaller companies. Like, quite a lot of the stuff that AI does or is trying to do at the moment, bigger companies could do, like, because they have massive budgets. But giving that same amount of power to someone who only has 5k a month, 10k a month budget is not a terrible thing. Like, it might actually create more competition in the market, you know, give smaller folk a chance of punching above their weight. With all things, a blessing and a curse. And, like, the unfortunate thing for any agency owner right now is you just kind of have to be a tech nerd for this. Like, we are going through a revolution, both in terms of how we create content and market and distribute, and also how people consume content and marketing and distribution. Like, you know, we got 20 years of basically Google and social media being and a good website build being the fundamentals of all marketing, and now we're in this world where virtual reality, augmented reality, social platforms that don't really play by the traditional rules are all coming into play. It is confusing, it's scary, and it's very difficult to stay on top of, but, like, that's the challenge. That's how you stay solvent as an agency. Unfortunately, you almost have to be an expert in digital tech and sociology to understand where people are and where they're consuming content.
Yeah. Well, team, listeners, this has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. We've talked about, AI, climate change, wildfires, cauldrons, innovation zones. I mean, what haven't we discussed? As always, we are just a DM or an email away. You can find us at Literal Humans on all socials. Please be sure to like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating on platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We've really appreciated your ears, your listenership today. And stay with us. We've got a really exciting quarter 3 of episodes coming up today that we've teed up. Lots of great conversations, lots of great new guests. And yeah, we look forward to talking with you.
We have Suhair Khan, the founder of Open Ended. We're very excited to have you here, Suhair. Do you want to say hello and a little bit about yourself before we get started?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's actually so nice to meet in person. It changes everything. So my name is Suhair, and how did we meet? Cambridge,
yes.
Cambridge, okay. So we met at Cambridge Tech Week, and I am the founder of a platform called Open Ended. We were actually founded, let's say, a couple of years ago while I was at Google, where I worked for over a decade. And Open Ended has been established as a cross-disciplinary lab and an incubator for AI. We're driven by research, creativity, and imagination. And our goal is really to create connections across the tech sector between the creative industries and culture.
What inspired you to start the organization?
So I spent the best part of my career at the intersection of technology and other industries and other disciplines. I started off working on the self-driving car at Google in California, which is sort of the ultimate manifestation of artificial intelligence, if you think about it. But of course, with real life, with engineering, with transportation, and of course, with humans. And from there, I've worked on products that range from education to social impact to Google Maps, YouTube. And then in London, I was working on arts and culture. So really building new products and platforms through Google to help to showcase the collections of museums, the work of curators, and to allow for artists, designers, architects, musicians to work with technologies like machine learning, virtual reality, hybrid realities in new and hopefully inspiring ways. So a lot of my work has been kind of in the space where creativity and innovation come together with tech, but I did feel over the years that because tech companies are so big, there is often a siloing between the creative sectors, arts, design, architecture, music, and access to resources and expertise in machine learning, hybrid realities, tech in general. And I wanted to create a space to facilitate that conversation.
How do you feel that your time at Google kind of shaped you, not personality, but almost like your morals or your grounding as a founder?
So, you know, it's thank you for asking this question. I mean, you and I were speaking earlier, and I think increasingly, I think it's important to be direct and radical when you talk about technology. I think we're at a very binary moment in how we consider the benefits and the anxieties around artificial intelligence in particular, but also the power dynamics associated with very large corporations having so much access to power and resource. The truth is that being within one for so long, many, many years, I had the chance to work with some of the most inspiring leaders, men, women, creatives from around the world, who really saw technology as hopeful. They were building and disseminating, you know, product managers, engineers, leaders of teams, leaders of countries and regions, for the purpose of really bringing new platforms and access to people around the world. So from a values perspective, I actually have always seen technology as being hopeful. I've seen the benefit of it being so quickly moving, so exponential in so many ways and how it grows. But also because within Google, I worked outside of technology so much. I worked with museums, with curators, I worked with schools, with principals even, ministers of education and culture. I also saw that there's different speeds. Yeah. And like sort of like the sense of like how we define time and space is actually shifting very rapidly in tech. Mm-hmm. And being at Google, I was able to actually sit in a really fortunate position of actually seeing that disconnect. And so one of the values that I think I really honed, particularly working on the arts and culture team at Google, was the understanding that people's incentives and priorities are different across disciplines. And that doesn't make either worse or wrong. There is just a there's a language that has to be found and space that has to be creative. And I think that that's where working somewhere like Google, you realize that you have sometimes like very large access to funding, resources, technological infrastructure, but you lack time and space in a way that shouldn't be the case. And for me, that's a thinking that kind of kept percolating over the course of my career, because I was confronted often in being on the side of the table that thought that technology and innovation is always good, like why not? As opposed to thinking about how we meld incentives, how we go through a process that's more like gardening relationships than just conducting an orchestra, because you know that it's going to be the best orchestra that ever existed because you've used machine learning to design it.
And I think through all of that, being able to actually still have hope is really interesting as well, because at Open Ended you support startups and organizations that are coming up in the tech world and try and help them. So can you speak specifically about any kind of ways that Open Ended supports these organizations, especially with what you just said, you know, understand that there are different incentives, different perceptions, and even this concept of time and space changing?
Thank you for asking this question. So when I started off, we really wanted to create a platform to showcase the work and ideas and ways of thinking of creatives working in an interdisciplinary way with technology, yeah, and vice versa. So we had coders, product managers, we had artists, designers, mm-hmm, and we were looking to unpack their own thinking and to create a community amongst them. Where we're at right now is thinking about how to make these ideas generative. So part of what we're doing is creating literally a think tank, a space where ideas can be formed and percolated and disseminated in a way that hasn't happened before in a cross-disciplinary way. So we're creating, I would say, a series of in-person events. We have a conference every year during London Design Festival on the future of intelligence and how we frame and define it. It's really bringing together technology, creativity, and design. And we have thought leaders from across different disciplines coming, participating, speaking, performing, inviting young people, students, but also professionals, creatives, techies, investors, to be part of a reminder that not only can technology be hopeful, that we can use creativity in a way as a Trojan horse, mm-hmm, to explore critical issues around bias in artificial intelligence, or how we set the rules of building in the metaverse, how we consider the role of imagination as we move into a new moment of what generative AI can do to each of us, how we consider the role and interplay of people from Africa, Asia, continents that are all engaging with the technologies that we're building today, but aren't necessarily part of the conversation for those people who are building and designing these technologies. So for me, that platforming and that think tank has been really important to creating a showcase of ideas that doesn't yet exist. The second part of what we're doing is actually building an incubator for individuals and organizations that are working at the intersection of creativity and artificial intelligence, providing them access to resources from a computing perspective, engineering talent, and also allowing them to build on their business and their idea in a way that's supporting their work, giving them confidence and distribution. And so what we have built now with Open-Ended is really a research laboratory focused on AI with a totally cross-disciplinary lens where anybody can apply to participate in this, because I believe that designing, researching through design, using the speculative or non-speculative design process in order to create new outcomes and ideas for where you can take artificial intelligence is something that's not happening necessarily in more academic settings because they're siloed within computer science departments and or within technology companies, which are, of course, focused in most ways on building and designing for efficiency.
How would you describe maybe your own personal thoughts as well as thoughts or missions of Open-Ended on ethics and any kind of impact on society, privacy, or considerations in that way? Like, what steps do you think could be taken to kind of ensure a more ethical and inclusive future in the realm of technology?
I think that it's a very big thing to take on the future or the definition of what ethics can or should be. Mm-hmm. As you and I both know, ethics are defined very differently in different cultures, in different societies, in so many different ways. Perspective varies. I think that we should be empowering young people, creatives, and people from across diverse backgrounds, whether it's neurodiverse, whether it's socioeconomic, whether it's what field of work they're in, whether it's whether or not they've had an educational degree at all, and empowering them to take a stand, to have a voice, and to be able to call out what their work is. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to set up this as a laboratory, because not only do we want to empower them to say, this is what I believe in, we want to empower them to build in a way to prove beyond just words. And I have had people say to me, well, it's really easy to sit around and like talk about bias in tech and to talk about ethics. You have to be leaning in and building and taking a stand. And I think it's hard. It's confusing and there's an insecurity around it. Mm-hmm. But equally, I don't think that anybody would be saying or using that language with me if I was a man, you know, who had like more of a sense of like what I represented and wasn't creating a more fluid ecosystem, which I hope is led and built by younger people who are maybe as nervous and as insecure about taking a stand, but are seeking a way of making money, building ideas, being innovators, changing the world in big and small ways, and to have technology be a tool which they are able to leverage. All we can do is to help each of these individuals to tap in, to channel, and to build. But that's really where we're at right now.
And you spoke there about your lecturing and speaking with students and the young people, I suppose, who in a few years will be the leaders in the tech industry. What kind of advice do you find yourself giving often to these aspiring tech founders or, you know, architectural developers, whatever they may be? And how do you find that they are being discouraged by the lack of representation or any kind of perceived barriers?
So I think I'm, you know, the students that I work with, although they come from many different backgrounds, I think they're already privileged to be at an amazing educational institution in London. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily representative of all of the young people around the world who are illiterate, who are disenfranchised, who are living in conflict zones and who are really in need of support and grounding. So that's the one thing I would say. And so there's anyone out there who wants to speak to me about that, I'm really interested in that. But of course, these are young people living in uncertain times as economies are shifting. And most of them are very strong in what they believe in, and they do want to do what they think is the right thing. So the first piece of advice I used to always give students was, it's okay. If you want to go work for Meta or Chanel or Hermes, that's cool. You carry your values and your vision no matter where you go. You must seek excellence in whatever you pursue, and you must seek authenticity to yourself and not be concerned about what society thinks of you or what is a wasteful industry or an industry that you don't believe in, because that for me is the biggest mistake. Because you lose a chance to do something that you're passionate about. You know, I have a young woman who's on my team. She's now at Meta. She's a product manager working on future-facing hybrid realities. It's so exciting.
Yeah.
It's so cool. It's expanding her world. She's working with some of the smartest engineers in the world. She has access to resources at a time where everything in that company is changing. Mm-hmm. And for her, I want her to shine and to grow and to consider how she brings her work, working with me in a very cross-disciplinary way, her master's in AI, all of the things that have built her as an individual to being a voice within the walls of a large institution. Whereas with others, of course you find there's discrimination. It's hard to get in. It's hard to speak the language if you're a creative person, to translate your work, to pitch your work. if you've built an amazing gaming platform and you want a gaming company to buy it from you or to invest in you, how do you speak that language? And that's one of the other things that I think we're able to provide now, and like what we're doing with our incubators, to say, how do we support you, not just to build and to invest in your engineering talent and your design work, but to make sure that it's being seen and heard, even though you might not be speaking the language that needs to be heard. And I think for young people, it's really important, first of all, to think about, of course, what matters to you, what you care about, and then where you want to go in life. And for that, you know, universities have resources, but the barriers are quite high. And I think you need to seek out mentors, you need to seek out support. With my career, I only did anything because of a mentor. I didn't expect it, I didn't plan it in that way. I had a very non-linear career at Google. I worked, you know, in multiple continents. I worked on multiple products. I was really lucky to move between different teams and ideas. It wasn't efficient. I was always bumping against walls and boundaries. It didn't serve me always, but it made me understand technology in ways that now are very useful because I saw it from so many different perspectives. And it's one of the reasons I think I probably always felt like I was a little bit on the edges looking in considering, why aren't we asking some questions where we could be asking them? And equally, why aren't we open to ideas when we could be open to them? Mm-hmm. And what is long-term thinking versus short-term thinking? And that is where I think that the more chance you give yourself to pursue what you believe in and to have people who hold your hand and to pull you up, which will always happen.
Yeah.
There is always somebody waiting there for you who says, I have the time for you. I want you to sit with me. Most people love it if you send them an email and ask for their thoughts. If you see somebody out there that you admire or you love, or I do it all the time,
yeah.
You know, is to say, will you give me half an hour of your time? I have like no agenda. I'm just curious about you, your work. I had this with Indy Johar, who's a designer, and he won the London Design Biennale medal last year, or London Design Festival. I'm on the jury of one of them. And so he won the other one's medal. And I really liked his work. So I emailed him 1,000 times. I watched up to him 1,000 times. I then met him somewhere. And he was really nice. He was just really busy. And he finally gave me his time. And I think with that, it helps because I have the confidence of having had the opportunity to meet many interesting people. And I'm really lucky for that. But I really encourage that because it is harder. It's harder to get jobs. It's harder to do things you care about. But one thing that I would say that I think is like something that I feel has benefited me is actually to work hard and to focus on one thing for any number of time, months, weeks, years in this moment is not a bad thing, because to have an expertise is a good thing.
And you know what? I think that brings us nicely onto the last question. You've had such a journey over time. And I think not only have you been influenced, you have influenced many. So looking forward, what are your aspirations for Open Ended? And in terms of yourself and impacting the creative technology industry and broader society, what do you want to see happening, and what are you hoping that will happen for you in your time? Big question.
So thanks for the question. I'm sure people have better answers. So I'm actually like, you know, I was saying this to you earlier, I get really anxious now when people ask me what I do, because I'm used to just saying I have a job. And now I do this, I'm trustee of multiple arts organizations. I do this teaching stuff.
Which is huge. Congratulations. Be proud.
Thank you. But then I have a panic and then I try. So what I would say, what I really want to, what I hope to do in this moment is to consider how we bridge to the future. Mm-hmm. I really think if we simplify, there seems to be a gap. Like we're standing on a precipice and we literally are being told to jump and we don't know where we go next. There is a bridge. It is possible to build it, and it's possible for all of us to somehow get onto it and to find a generative way of moving forward. And that I think also involves bridging people from different disciplines, yes. Particularly creativity, academia, research. I think anything that happens next, innovation is going to be driven by creative thinking in the future. And pairing that with algorithms is where we're going to evolve. So for me, I really want open-ended to become an ecosystem for a space where we're reframing how we invest in technology going forward, and we're reframing how we invest in innovation going forward, where we're creating more time, more space, and more consideration of what is actually valuable in the future. I just am much more aware that everything is connected much more than we consider when we talk about individual innovations in AI or individual destructions of our climate or individual political events. And I think if we can create ecosystems that are holistic, that channel a holistic way of thinking, I would hope to be part of a conversation of really creating an empowering space that, even whether in big or small ways, is driven by research, by cross-disciplinary practice and has a sense of impact on at least the communities which serve it.
And I look forward to, in the future, maybe having a conversation again about all the things that, since we speak now, have happened and developed. So thank you so much for sharing your perspective. But before you go, could you share with our audience where they can find you, where they can find more information about Open Ended and anything that's coming up for Open Ended that they should be aware of?
Oh, thank you. So yeah, so you can find me on Instagram. I actually like replying to messages on Instagram because it's a good way of like saving my distraction from other stuff. LinkedIn, and then Open Ended, we have a conference coming up later this year in the autumn on the futures of intelligence. We're looking at how you reframe the idea of intelligence from outside of the purely cognitive to creative intelligence, physical intelligence, the intelligence of plants, species, ecology, and that's going to be hopefully a celebration and an experience. We did the same thing last year during London Design Festival. This is going to be at a bigger stage, so stay tuned and get involved. Come, we have free tickets for anybody who can't afford a ticket, so definitely make sure you keep that in mind. And we're setting up our research lab, so if you're interested in that, supporting, getting involved, it's at the intersection of creativity and artificial intelligence. I'd love to chat. And then finally, I actually did want to say that I find, you know, as I said to you earlier, the talking bit is the thing I'm most nervous of right now, but I'm really happy to have met you, Rebecca. It's been really inspiring. You have such a depth of perspective and vision, and you're brave and you're bold, and I'm really grateful to have had this time with you. So I hope you do many more of these.
Thank you so much. I feel so inspired by this conversation. It's great to have you join us, so thank you for that.
Thank you so much.